Episode 32, let's go.
Unibody Council, Medic 1. Medic 1 inbound to your facility, emergency traffic with a 45-year-old male in cardiac arrest. Following multiple gunshot wounds, Medic 1 in progress, patient intubation, IO in place. Wait with you in 5 minutes.
Welcome to the EMS Handoff, your source for all things EMS. And now, let's welcome to the show your hosts, Bradley Dean, Eric McCullough, and David Blevins.
Hello, and welcome to the EMS Handoff Podcast. It's David, along with my co-host, Eric McCullough, and Bradley Dean. We are your source for all things EMS. Tonight, though, is going to get real. A huge topic in EMS, in public safety in general. And our guest today is like I said, going to bring that real topic. So we're going to get into that here in just a minute. But this episode is actually coming up during Memorial, right out the Wednesday after Memorial Day. So we're going to start off here just a little bit different than normal. You know, a lot of times you hear people talk about thanking those in service, but Memorial Day is a time to pay tribute to those that weren't able to come home. And so for all of those that made the decision and the families that have supported since then, thank you for the service and for the dedication to do what you've done for our country. And on this Memorial Day, let's just remember everything that has gone into those decisions and why this day has come together. So for all those families, we thank you for allowing your families to go off and do great things and protect our country, and for them never giving back, we say thank you and offer our thoughts and prayers to those individuals from many decades back. So on that note, let's go ahead and start off with our conversation with my fellow compatriots from the green side. We're going to go ahead and say hello to Eric McCullough from Nashville. What's up?
Hey, so this is an exciting week. Yeah, this is the final week of coach pitch baseball and softball for my kids. So I have learned. I had to help coach and stuff. Here's the one thing I have learned. When it comes to kids, like a six-year-old, the only goal is to try to get the minimum amount of kids running after the ball. That's what I found out. Like, you want to diminish it from five, we got them down to, I think, three last week. So here's hoping in 2 days that they'll be down to at least two running after the ball. And then if they can do that, man, that's great.
That, you know, you have goals for the kids, you have goals for the coaching. And one of the key things, luckily I never coached baseball. That would, I took my foray into middle school girls basketball. That's a horse of a different color, but yes, the catcher trying to run to right field is not typically needed. So let's go to the other side, North Carolina, Bradley Dean.
Man, it's been a great week. And I am glad to see that you have graduated from the mason jar to just drinking straight out of the jug.
just the jug. I didn't take time to pour my water in a cup today. So no jar. It's still on the dining room table. Forgot it. So. Yeah, you know, some days are just like that. So, you know, we'll see how it goes the rest of the day. So before we introduce our guest, we'd like to thank our podcast partner, the Journal of Emergency Medical Services. Jim has been a great partner in the EMS Handoff Podcast, and they've been an industry leader for many years. So while we remain the source for all things EMS in the podcast verse, make sure to go by and check out our podcast partner, Jim's. Not only do you see the up-to-date information that they have from a variety of things or upcoming conferences, but you also get to check all of our episodes. And, you know, they do have some other podcasts. I'm going to have to make sure that the other ones are out there doing the same for us. You know, we promote them, go visit them, make sure they come visit us too. But they're doing great things out there. Make sure and go by and visit. Also, don't forget to go by and subscribe on their platforms, Apple, Google, and Spotify on the EMS Today podcast. Make sure you get all of our episodes. And we would like to also mention our official EMS Handoff merchandise partner, the Pursuit Company. They've got our stylish gear. You notice I got the white shirt on. I believe Bradley's got the red shirt, and Eric's just being a bum. I don't know what his deal is, you know. But make sure and go by and visit the Pursuit Company at pursuitco.com. EMSHandoff.com. They did update their website. And remember, you can go to /EMSHandoff and check out our gear. And the ones that we've been talking about, our Keep Back line, is actually printing now. They've had it up on the website for the last couple of weeks. Screens are there. Should have my first order tomorrow, and we'll be able to show off those awesome new shirts. We spent a long time on that. Bradley, it's time to kick the pig and let's go.
So tonight we're joined by Philip Wabi, who earned his Associate of Applied Science in EMS and a paramedic from St. Louis Community College, where he graduated in 1988. As a St. Louis City paramedic, he spent 12 years on the front lines providing emergency care and crisis intervention in a variety of emergency settings, receiving multiple Dressel Life-Saving Awards for his work. He effectively works with people and leads efforts to still allow him to save lives in a different capacity now. In 2017, Philip completed the training in mental health first aid through Missouri Recovery Network, as well as the Recovery Community Organization Boot Camp. Philip, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. And, you know, I'm excited to do this. And this is a very near and dear topic to me. You know, like you said, my name is Philip Wabi. I am a heroin addict. I just celebrated 10 years in sobriety on May the 24th of 2011. That ultimately is what led to me not being able to work for the City of St. Louis Fire Department as a paramedic anymore. I committed some crimes to maintain a heroin habit. Like I said, I tried heroin once for like 30 years. And, you know, I think everybody can relate to this as being emergency care providers, that it's in your heart. It's not just a job. It's something that we do because we love it. We love helping people. When I wasn't able to do that no more as consequences to my choices, I was heartbroken. You know, I remember the day that I resigned because I was allowed to resign from the fire department, that, you know, I was in tears. I was in uniform, and I walked out of our fire department headquarters. One of the training officers there basically told me if I didn't change, I was going to die. And, you know, most people, normal people would probably change that at that point. I went out in my vehicle, left, and proceeded to, get high. Didn't solve my problem, but that was where my mind was. I figured I didn't have anything else to really do. That was what I was supposed to do. So, you know, I was able to, through time, it took me a while to get sober. I like to call it field research. I had to do a lot of field research, and, you know, I got to, I got to experience homelessness. I got to experience facets of the criminal justice system. I had never gone to prison, but I was arrested numerous times for a variety of just silly crimes, stealing. Then when I decided to get sober in 2011, two friends of mine, we decided that heroin addicts were dying needlessly. So we started an organization at that time to harm reduction. At that time, Narcan was available on ambulances and in ALS situations, but it wasn't available to the community. So we basically were distributing Narcan to people that were in active substance use disorder to try and help them facilitate recovery. You can't recover if you're dead. So, you know, we did that. We also started handing out clean kits, you know, syringe access. And we were doing this out of the trunk of our car. Our phones would ring and we would have people say, hey, I, you know, can you meet up with me? I need, you know, clean kits, or I need Narcan. I had to use my Narcan, you know, the other night, or what have you. So we would meet them in alleys at all times of the day and give them this stuff. Eventually it turned into an organization to where we got laws passed here in Missouri for the Good Samaritan Law, which grants limited immunity for someone at the scene of an overdose to call 911 and not have the repercussions of getting locked up for, say, a traffic warrant, because that is what people would do. They would dump bodies from heroin overdoses because they were afraid they're going to go to jail for a speeding ticket that they didn't go to court for. That's crazy. It also gives limited immunity if there's, you know, small amounts of drugs or paraphernalia on the scene. But it's helping to save lives. It also allowed access, public access to Narcan, to where you can go into, you know, a pharmacy and get it. Our organization hands it out for free. That was funded by grants. But prior to that, we were handing it out through private donations through a not-for-profit organization, which is named Missouri Network for Opiate Reform and Recovery. That's where our, it's a recovery community center. Essentially, it's, you can drop in at any time, Monday, well, 7 days a week, and during the day, and you can get resources to get into treatment that, you know, Narcan, clean using supplies, somebody to talk to, whatever. We meet people with substance use disorder where they are at. We don't stigmatize them for being that, because I am. The only difference between me and them is that I decided to change my life and make it better. I do that through a 12-step organization, which there's a variety of them. Is that the only way to get sober? No. There are multiple pathways to recovery. A lot of these intensive outpatient programs that I was referring to, that we can refer people to, for our uninsured or underinsured people, we can have you in front of a physician, get you medications, buprenorphine, within maybe, you know, 2 days, 3 days tops, and you're in an intensive outpatient program. Some of these programs will even pay your rent and sober living, which I've helped start those too. And I believe that, you know, to go into the foundation of that, I can a little deeper in my story, but, you know, these are all resources that weren't available 6 years ago. You know, the federal government even it started injecting money into this through these state targeted opioid response grants. You know, the stigma of opiate use disorder, or just we'll say substance use disorder, is it's crazy. I mean, most people, when they think alcoholic or drug addict, they think about the guy on Skid Row that's drinking wine out of a bottle, or, you know, that type of person. It's not that way anymore. There's doctors, lawyers, nurses, paramedics, firefighters, police officers. I mean, you know, it has no boundaries. This is a disease of the mind. And I know, you know, this is going to medical professionals, and the definition of a disease is a chronic reoccurring issue that has no cure. Well, substance use disorder is chronic. It is reoccurring. It cannot be cured, but however, it can be arrested or stopped. But it's always there, just like cancer. It's chronic, it's reoccurring, it can be treated. And I, you know, the cure of it is it could come back. And that's just like substance use disorder. I know as an emergency responder, I felt the same way too. At 3 o'clock in the morning, the tone drops, you run to the truck, and you're going to get, you know, a narcotics overdose, or you're going to get somebody that has a mental health disorder. And it's like, man, I went to school to learn how to be a ambulance cab driver, for lack of better words. Well, that's my job. I am supposed to help. When the tone drops, these people are in a situation which is an emergency to them. It may not be an emergency to me, but it's an emergency to them. And they're human beings, and they have a crisis going on in their life. I hear a lot of people say, well, it's because of a choice you make. It is a choice. It starts as a choice, but STDs are a choice too, and they're a disease. You know, it's a consequence of your actions. It's with substance use disorder, there's a line somewhere. And, you know, some of us cross that line, and the disease hijacks our brain. And that is the only thing that we think about is staying well.
Hey, Philip, since you're talking about this part, I'm just curious. So what was it that, what is your story in this? When this started to impact you? Because, I completely and I think a lot of the listeners and stuff here, in our EMS handoff groups and stuff, go to a lot of substance abuse patients and stuff. But you've actually been there. So you've been a paramedic, you've been an addict, you've been through recovery and stuff. So what was it specific about you that alerted you to this addiction, I guess?
I'm going to say that it was the unmanageability of my life. Like I said, on May the 23rd, 2011, essentially I walked out of a department store that I had been frequenting and sticking jewelry in my pocket. I was stopped that time, and a little security guard had asked me, you know, he wanted his jewelry back, and I gave him his jewelry back. I was under the impression I'm going to give his jewelry back and I'm going to go home. That didn't happen. I got arrested that night for stealing. I went to jail and I was released pending application of warrants. That next day, actually not even that next day, at that moment when he was stopped giving my jewelry back, I was homeless. I was living in a roach motel, you want to call it, you know, pay by the week motel. I had already gone through an entire house. And when I say I went through that house, I sold everything in that house. Craigslist. I put the kitchen cabinets, the garbage disposal, the air, and everything I sold in that house to maintain a sense of normalcy, to stay well. So what went through my head at that point in time was, I don't want to live like this no more. I'm going to have to repeat this on and on and on and on, and I need to change. And that was where I decided, when I got out of jail that night, I went back to that house that I had sold everything in. Granted, it was May. It was like it was, you know, today in St. Louis. It was warm. Threw a mattress on the basement floor because it was cooler in the basement. And I woke up the next day and I walked to a clubhouse, which is a recovery clubhouse, because that's all we had at the time. We didn't have these community organizations. And I just kept asking for help. Finally, I got on the telephone and called the counselor that I had known and told him I needed help. And he said, be here tomorrow. And he got me in treatment the next day. You know, it was at that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I was not the person that I felt I should have been. I was a criminal. I mean, bottom line, that's what I was. You know, whether you're stealing jewelry or you're stealing a cracker, you're stealing. And that wasn't me. I was going to die if I continued to go down that road of active addiction. So, you know, I went to treatment and I did the 30-day treatment program. And, you know, I did what's suggested. I did it somebody else's way because I have that disease that, you know, half my brain produces BS and my other half buys it. And I go out and I do those things. I think alcoholics and drug addicts, we shouldn't be held responsible for our first thought, but we should definitely be held responsible for our first action because, you know, we know better. You know, I'm just glad that I don't have to live like that anymore. I mean, 10 years, a decade was like, wow. It was amazing.
So Phil, I want to go, and this is, you know, in the introduction, we really kind of hit this because this has been a huge topic within the EMS community, and you've talked a lot so far, and we're going to get into a lot more detail on this, but I want to rewind the clock just a little bit because I have a feeling that your story is very similar to a lot of individual stories when it comes to this profession about how they get there. You kind of mentioned already that, you know, this isn't a bad person disease. You know, it's isolated only to people that do bad things. There's a lot of people in this country from, like you said, paramedics, physicians get involved with this, judges, lawyers, doctors, you name it out there, and it happens. And it happens to some really good people, and some bad things happen. So let's go ahead and go far enough back that we kind of talk about how you decided to get into this profession at the beginning.
My father was a police officer, and you know, like every other kid, you think, man, I want to be a policeman like my dad. You want to do what your dad does. And he was a police officer when I was a youngster. He used to, and how he did it, I have no idea. This was in the 70s, but on Christmas Eve, he would take me out in the police car with him. And it always seemed like in this little town of Shrewsbury, Missouri, that Christmas Eve was, because I was with them, was a busy night. But I wanted to be like my dad. I wanted to be this police officer. Well, one day I was like 13, 14 years old, and my dad handed me the orange books, Emergency Care and Transportation of the Sick and Injured. And I started looking through them, and I was like, man, this is pretty cool. So I got involved in an emergency medical explorer post here in St. Louis that was called Carondelet Area Rescue Patrol. Essentially, we did first aid stations at school picnics, different functions. And then, you know, even we have like a veiled prophet parade on the 4th of July. And our advisor was a nurse, and he was involved with the Red Cross. So we were able to kind of tag along with the Red Cross at these larger event first aid stations. And I mean, we're 14 years old with a standard first aid card, and we're like getting exposed to big boy medicine stuff. And man, it was cool. I wanted to do that. It turned into me. Didn't make me a very good high school student because at the time I was able to enter into the field of emergency medicine with a GED. Partying was present in my life then, marijuana and alcohol. So the St. Louis public school system didn't have classes quite the time that I wanted to go to school. I got pulled into ultimately truant court with my mother, and like I said, my dad was a policeman. My mom worked for the court system, so she knew this judge, and the judge kind of, I guess, recessed court and took us into his chambers, and he said, Philip, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, well, I want to be a St. Louis City paramedic. Granted, I was 16 years old, and he goes, do you have a plan to do this? And I said, well, I was going to go to work for my uncle at a service station. He was going to loan me the money to go to EMT school. And I would work for him, pay off this student loan, per se, from my uncle, and go to the community college. So I did that. After that, I graduated that program. I started to work for a private ambulance service at the time that was just Abbott Ambulance. And the private service gave me the opportunity to get the exposure of being on an ambulance. I know everybody wants to go run trauma and they want to run 911 calls, but you know, I had to get in where a nursing home transfer was a nursing home transfer. They're people too. They needed care. I applied with the city of St. Louis. I tested and I hung around these guys. I was that, like I said, I was an EMS explorer or an emergency medical explorer. We weren't affiliated with the EMS systems in St. Louis, but I went and, you know, I'd go, they worked out of police stations at the time. So I was that little kid that would show, well, not little kid, but 14-year-old kid that would show up and talk to these guys, you know, can I get a tour of the ambulance? Can I do this? What's that? Asking questions because I was curious. So the day that I went to the my practical exam for the city of St. Louis, the paramedic supervisor that was giving me the test looked at me and he goes, boy, you better shine, because he knew the people that I was hanging around with. And it wasn't that, you know, it's a practical exam. You can't get the answer. You just got to do it. And so I grabbed two Plano 747 tackle boxes that had some weight to them and proceeded to walk around this old police station, which was EMS headquarters, go down the steps into this large classroom, and there laid a Recessa Annie. And as soon as I set those 747 boxes down, the training officer, Chief Yancey, said, you arrived on an automobile accident. This is your patient. They're ejected from the automobile. I began to do what was in my, you know, primary survey, secondary survey, CPR. At the time, we were using EOAs, dropped an EOA, controlled the airway. And this was EMT stuff. So and then I was hired. I was able to become what I wanted to become. And that was a medic for the city of St. Louis. The first night after my orientation, a 2-week orientation, I went from doing nursing home transfers to working on Medic 10. At the time, there was a hospital in St. Louis. It was a psychiatric hospital called Malcolm Bliss Hospital. It's no longer, they tore it down. But our ambulances ran out of different hospital emergency rooms or police stations at the time because it was under the Department of Health and Hospitals. And I remember I was working with, I can say her name is Laurie LaCavoli. She's a fire marshal now at Pattonville, Missouri. And we got a call for a pediatric cardiac arrest in the low income housing projects, which were right by Malcolm Bliss. And I haven't seen that. Probably the youngest patient I had saw up to that point was probably 82 years old, maybe. I don't know, because it was all nursing home transfers. And I looked over at her and I was like, I don't know what, you know, and she was like, you're the senior person on the truck, it's your call. And so it was kind of trial by fire, naturally in the EMS system. Got there and it wound up being a stuffed up nose or something. It wasn't a pediatric cardiac arrest. Thank God, because that probably wouldn't have ended well as my first call in a major metropolitan EMS system. I would have done my best. I would have done my job, but you know, we've all been there and it's just like, And I continued that career. I worked on some of the busiest trucks in the busiest parts of the city at the busiest times. Our service at, well, it still is actually, 12 ambulances for a population that swells up to 3 million people during the day. They ran at that time 98,000 calls a year. I remember working nights, eight at night till late in the morning at a out of the Area 3 police station, which was at Union and Margaretta, which is a pretty rough part of Walnut Park. It's a pretty rough part of town now. It was even then, back in the late 80s, early 90s, because of the Crips and Bloods. You know, I mean, we're breaking homicide records still. We were definitely breaking them then. And I was up there by choice. It was where I wanted to be. It was fast paced. I worked flawlessly in chaotic situations. Later to find out that I like to create chaotic situations to feel normal. I wanted to touch on, which I think had a little bit to do maybe it had a lot to do with the substance use, was we're running 18 calls a night in a 12-hour shift. Out of those 18 calls, I mean, hit or miss, it could be 12, 13 of them were critical patients. We were getting pulled, like transported shooting to the hospital. They're pulling you in service to go to another shooting around the corner, or a stabbing or an assault or a true MI. And the only time that we were given to think about processing that call was while we were wiping the blood off the equipment to go do it again. So I had to do something that, you know, all the flyers back then at EMS said you needed to be psychologically stable to do this job. And I was psychologically stable to do the job, but we as EMS providers, we're human and we're not designed to deal with death and dying to the degree that we were doing or holding. I mean, we saw things that nobody will ever see in their life, and we were called to deal with that. So I had to numb those feelings, the normal feelings of mourning and just feeling, period. So I numbed it, and I numbed it through drugs and alcohol. I mean, I don't think anybody's ever drank with a cop, have they? Probably not. You know, policemen don't drink, but we used to go to a choir practice at 6-7 o'clock in the morning, and that was at the bar, and we just processed everything that way by drinking.
So it was more of a slow, steady. It wasn't like a one singular event. It was just over time, like a pressure cooker almost, like just slowly.
Yes. Yeah. I think it wasn't like, I mean, I did it for 12 years and it just progressed as time went on. I mean, when I first started at the city, I wasn't legal to drink. I couldn't go to the bars, but all the guys were like, it's kind of like being in the military. You know, you're 18 years old, you can go off to war, but you can't drink. You know, you can drive a tank, but you can't drink. You know, you're so we just, you know, they just figured I was a big guy anyway, so I looked older than I actually was. But and mind you, I had smoked pot prior to that. That was my go-to thing. I think the first drunk I remember, I was 8 years old and I hurt myself. I ran into a big metal wrought iron thing serving beer at my brother's 21st birthday party, but they thought it was the cute little kid pouring beer and I'm drinking foam, but 8 years old, you know, it did something for me. It made everybody go, ha ha, look at him. Everybody paid attention to me, you know, and I like that. Everybody likes that, I think, but, you know, I couldn't stop. I mean, I was at 8 years old, I did, but drugs and alcohol made me feel different than the way I was feeling. So
with that, Philip, so it kind of drove you down the pathway. So let's talk a little bit about after you got started, and the whole part of this is a couple of years ago, you did a video called Not My Addiction.
Right.
You were one of the people in that. So let's talk a little bit about the stigma of addiction that goes with this.
Like I said earlier in my long drawn out introduction there, there's a lot of stigma surrounding substance use disorder. It's not limited to just, you know, the how can I say, the skid row type housing displaced people. It's not. That organization I talked about forming, early in the podcast, the gentleman that I helped form it with was a Cook County prosecuting attorney that doesn't want to be a lawyer no more, but he was a full-blown heroin addict, just like I was, a lawyer. Addiction doesn't know any socioeconomic barriers. I was looking at some statistics before this from 2020, and it's like rampant in African American males are dying from this disease. It was, you know, you always hear, oh, it's in suburbia, white suburbia now. No, it's killing human beings. It's killing kids. But the stigma that's surrounded around it is it's like you're looked down on because you have this disease, this illness that, you know, everybody thinks it starts from a choice. And it's yes, you have a choice in the beginning, but people that are predisposed to this disease, which I believe is genetic, it flips that light switch in you and you can't stop. Nobody starts using substances to say, you know, that's what I want to be. When I was a kid, I didn't aspire to be the zigzag man. You know, I wanted to be a St. Louis City paramedic. But addiction took me to places that made some things happen in my brain, which didn't make me think like normal people. And it, as you kept going, nobody wants to be addicted to drugs. You know, and in saying that, the thing that we use at like high school talks is Johnny's a football player, freshman year, blows his knee out, goes to the doctor, gives Vicodin, likes Vicodin. It tripped that thing in his head. He continued to use Vicodin. Eventually, the doctor said, well, your injury's healed. You don't need it no more. Well, then he realizes that there's substances on the street that are easily available for $5 a pill that make him feel 100 times better, fentanyl. And he doesn't realize what he's getting himself into, winds up doing too much. And the next thing you know, he's in the back of our ambulance. If somebody calls 911, he's a human being too. He needs that help. It's no different than a diabetic. It's no different than someone that has seizures. That used to be my object. I'm a hypocrite. Then Dilantin was the Dilantin Phenobarb for seizure disorders. You drink Dilantin, don't work. So then you're wondering, people are having seizures and they're wondering why. It's like, well, it's because you're drinking. Well, you know what? They probably had a disease of alcoholism and they couldn't stop drinking and they didn't have the resources to stop drinking. Nowadays, there's more resources out here for that, especially, you know, I'm not trying to get off topic here, but when someone overdoses, the last thing they want to do is be Narcan. That ruins the high. We know it blocks the opiate receptors. Therefore, the opiate can't break through that barrier. And now you're thrown into withdrawal. You're angry. You're sick. You don't want to go to the hospital. You want to go get high. That's the disease of addiction. Transporter. I know you can't force them to go, but in Missouri, we have a program called EPIC, which is emergency room peers that go to the emergency rooms that they're people just like me that have lived experience and we can facilitate ongoing care for them and get them into treatment, hopefully save their lives. You know, in that movie or mini docu thing, Not My Addiction, it was Ray had contacted me and thought, you know, this will be great. Target audience is going to be first responders to help remove the stigma of first responders. I was the only person in that video that did not experience an overdose. I've reversed a million of them, but I've never overdosed myself. I don't know why that is. But I just didn't experience it. The other girls that were in there, they're still sober, by the way, if you do watch it, they're all still sober. They're all leading productive lives. As a matter of fact, the first Hannah L, I think, is having another baby. The other Hannah that's, now she's, and I'm okay with this anonymity thing. She's an RN. She's been, God bless her, working day in, day out at a major hospital here in St. Louis through all this pandemic and stuff. And she's still sober. So everybody there was given the opportunity to ongo their lives from opiate reversals by first responders or by having layperson Narcan access. I know Ray had me read a card that was, he got it from some social media site. And it was a firefighter that stated, "I don't get paid any more money to give Narcan. Let the junkies die." I think that's what it said. My response to that was, I was angered. That still angers me. But I also said that you don't get paid any more money to push epinephrine, you know. So I down 4 cheeseburgers, clog my left anterior descending. I code, you're doing your job. You're giving me this medication to save my life. It's not for you. We can't play God, you know. We can't play God. It's. And that just ticked me off, you know, when I heard that, because
yeah. And I mean, I will tell you, I keep up with both Hannahs and you, and to watch Hannah read that in that documentary, I know that emotionally that just tore her apart. Nobody ever intends to get addicted, to overdose, and these people don't want our Narcan. They want our care and our compassion. But my question is do the healthcare providers, the paramedics, the nurses, the physicians that these people encounter following an overdose have the resources or know what resources are available to help these individuals get into recovery?
I think in Missouri, we've come pretty far with that. And when I say in Missouri, I don't know what other states are doing. I'll talk about St. Charles County Ambulance District here in the St. Louis metro area. They actually, through their community support division, they do leave behind Narcan. They do follow-ups with the folks that the patients that they had, and they try and keep that continuum of care going. They have developed relationships with treatment centers around the area that if these people want to go to treatment, they can pick up the phone and get them in treatment. Like I was saying earlier, this intensive outpatient programs that are in the St. Louis area now are a big deal. I mean, we have drop-in mental health centers now where you can just, you don't necessarily have to go to the hospital. You can walk into one of these drop-in mental health centers and I'm a heroin addict, I need help. And they are going to facilitate a way or an avenue for you to get into treatment. And they're going to follow up with you. That's what that peer recovery support specialist is a person that basically does warm handoffs in the continuum of care. Take you to treatment, get you to the doctor, get you to a thrift store if you don't have a pair of shoes, plug you into all these resources that are already in the community and follow up, help you set goals, help you, you know, if you can't get to a meeting, they take you to a meeting. That's what saved my life is going to meetings. That was that EPIC program I told you about, that they respond to the emergency rooms, the behavioral health network, and they're called from the social workers or the ER staff. One of the hospitals in St. Louis is Barnes Jewish. there's a couple of them, but Big Barn is down on North Kings Highway. I'm sorry. It is a level one trauma center. It is in an area that receives a lot of the lower income patients because, I mean, really, in St. Louis City, we have three hospitals in the city of St. Louis now. So you're either going to St. Louis University, you're either going to Barnes Hospital, or you're going to, I think it's called Election Brothers still. They might've gotten bought out by somebody else. And then, I'm sorry, four, there's St. Mary's. All of these hospitals have been in-serviced on these programs that are out here. We've even got for expecting mothers, there's a what's called the Hope Clinic, and it's through St. Mary's Hospital where you can be addicted to opiates and they take you in there. They put you on medication to help you wean off of the illegal drugs and onto the Suboxone. And they follow you. They make you go to meetings. They make you do these things. So when you do have this child, he's not born in withdrawal. You may have, you know, your life together to where you can provide and be a mom for this mother or for this child. I think the resources have come very far, and they're in all the communities now, because this isn't just a St. Louis, Missouri problem. It's everywhere. I mean, it's, and you have to reach out to your as first responders, reach out to your treatment facilities, reach out to your emergency rooms, reach out to, an anonymous program in your area and find out where the meetings are. They've got an app that's called Meeting Guide that you can be in Germany and it's going to tell you where the meetings are based on where you're at. All opiate addicts and alcohol dependent folks obviously need medical detox, benzos, they need medical detox. And I think that the, with insurance, it's, you can go to the Betty Ford Clinic when you got insurance, but you know what Betty Ford Clinic can do? They're going to say, you're going to give them $60,000 and they're going to tell you to go to an anonymous organization when you get out of there, get a sponsor and maintain your sobriety that way. Granted, there are co-occurring disorders where, you know, people have bipolar problems, manic depressive, schizophrenia, all those things. That can also lead to substance use disorder because, like with ADHD, they give you these medications that are stimulants that slow you down. Well, people that aren't being diagnosed with it, the doctor treat thyself, they start using a street methamphetamine, and you know what? They feel normal. They can do their laundry. They can go to work. They can do the dishes. They can take care of themselves. But then eventually that chemical, because it's match heads and whatever, anhydrous pneumonia, changes the chemistry in your brain, and now it stops working. Whereas, you know, pharmaceuticals and medications, they're designed and you're monitored by a medical professional that they're going to ask you questions. Do you feel suicidal? Do you feel homicidal? How's this medicine working for you? And they dial it in and now you're normal. There's people that go to doctors to get these medicines and they don't pick up another medication in their life because it was untreated mental health. And there again, like I said in the beginning, people call 911 because they're having a mental health crisis. And I'm a hypocrite. I've done it. I've treated these people not the way I should have. Call it EMS burnout. You know, I'm more important.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Unfortunately, what we see is they go out, they give Narcan. The first thing that happens when they wake up is they ask them, do you know what just happened to you? You know, you need to get some help. Instead of being compassionate with them and making the connection, then they tend to drive them further into addiction.
Right.
This is where this is where I bring in a quote that one of my colleague instructors likes to say, and it was one that he was actually passed on when he was actually at EMT school. And, you know, he laid out that the instructor laid out all this equipment in front of him. This is the way this instructor kind of told it to me. He lays out all this equipment. He goes, "Hey, what is the most important piece of equipment that you have?" And so, you know, jumping up there, they're like, "Oh, it's got to be this." And he's like, "No, the answer is every patient needs a kind word and a gentle touch." And I think that's really where it is. We can have our opinions. And, you know, I commonly discuss that, you know, the one thing that none of us is the fact that not a single one of us are a judge. We may go serve on a jury one day. And at that point in time, you know, we're given the responsibility of making a judgment on somebody. However, in our role every day, it's to take individuals that are having a bad day and try to make it better. And sometimes it is that. It's a kind word and a gentle touch. And that's what's going to help to motivate some people. And it's kind of interesting what you said at the very beginning. It's like you had to make the decision. And for you, it was a bad day with the law enforcement. You know, there's been plenty of times where if somebody would have just come at you a little bit differently, then this conversation may never have happened. You know, it could have continued to escalate. So, Phil, we've certainly appreciated your time, and we'll give you a brief opportunity to kind of wrap us up today. And just if you could give our listeners, you know, EMS providers across the country, what they should know if they would have ever had Phil during his time, what would you have wanted them to know?
First off, I'd want them to know, like you said, be kind and compassionate. A great word of encouragement can go, you know, a long way. For what I do, just me too. Just saying, you know what, me too. I've had bad days. I've felt the way you're feeling. There is a solution to this. Let me get you some help. I think that we need to treat people, not that we don't, but that treat everybody as a human being, kind and compassion, love and tolerance to all. You know, if they want to go to the hospital because you just extricated a cockroach out of their ear and there's nothing wrong with them, take them to the hospital. They may have something else going on with them that they need help for. Just kind and compassion. You know, and I'm available to discuss. I don't know how you guys can do it, but you can get my email address out. And if there's anything that I can do to help further community engagement, I will. I can, you know, plug into some of the people here in St. Louis that have started these Leave Behind Narcan programs with these EMS services and how they do it. We tried to do something with the county police where they had what was called the Mo phone, and because of confidentiality, they couldn't give us the addresses and that names of the patient, but the police officer could hand them a phone that we provided and they could call us at that moment and be like, "Hey, I was just reversed from an opiate overdose. How can you help me?" And we can, you know, further that. But for legal reasons, we weren't able to pull that off. So kind and compassion, pay attention to mental health. Also pay attention to your own mental health and self-care. You know, like I said, we're first responders. We deal with people's problems. Nobody calls 911 for us to come chat with them. They call 911 because they're having a crisis. And we have to process that stuff. We have to work the problem and be a part of the solution. But honestly, it takes a toll on us, just like veterans that seek I've had people tell me I saw more combat in the city streets than they did in Vietnam. Take care of ourselves. The mental health care for first responders has come leaps and bounds from the way it was 20 years ago. Please take care of yourself. And I think that can carry on into how you take care of your patients too, because you understand them. So.
Well, Phil, what I'm going to ask you to do here, we're going to put your email address in our show notes, but go ahead and give it to the listeners. And if anybody wants to get a hold of Phil for some of these resources or just continue the conversation about where this is. So, Phil, if you would go ahead and give your email address, and that way we can share it out for you.
My email address is phil@monetwork.org. That's P as in Paul, H-I-L, at monetwork.org. I'll give you that, and then you can email me, and then I'll give you my telephone number. For obvious reasons, I don't want to put my telephone number out to the world right here. But I'll help. You know, if it's for you, if it's for a family member, if it's for your EMS service, police department, whatever, I will plug you into resources that are probably already in your community. And if our job is to save lives. If this saves one life, great. I did my job. I did what I believe I was put on this earth to do, and that's help others.
And normally I kick it over at this point to Bradley and Eric, but I'm going to take a moment to share my final thoughts here as well, because I think this is as big a situation as anything. As a pre-hospital provider, you know, I take a look at the hazmat community and the time I served there. One of the big things was you didn't have to know everything. You needed to know how to get a hold of everything. And that was one of the things that we need to know here is if we have somebody in front of us and we have no clue where to get them the resources, how do we get that information? And so I encourage everybody in their communities to know who they need to reach out. For us, for me, it was easy. We had an EMS division liaison that served in that role and was able to get out to the many different resources out there, whether it was resources for the elderly, resources for the disadvantaged, resources for special needs, resources for this. It was one of those calls. And you knew that if dispatch was to give them a call at 2:00 in the morning, they knew it was their job to pick that up and take that on. And so if you don't know where to get it, know how to get to the information to get it. And that's going to make all of our patients' outcomes a lot better. Find that individual, find where that information is. Now I'm going to kick it over to Bradley for his final thoughts tonight.
So I just want to echo what David was saying. Regardless of what community you work in, find out who your mental health network provider is. I am sure that they have some resources that you can call at 1, 2, or 3 o'clock in the morning. So you can hand off that patient to the appropriate people, because addiction has a mental health component to it. And if you can take care of that piece for that person, that can help move them to recovery.
Great, great words there. How about you, Eric?
My thing would just be to watch out for compassion fatigue. I think it's easy to let your own stresses of working long shifts, hard shifts, or continued shifts dealing with patients to impact your care for somebody else. And I think it's just good to slow down, recognize that that might be happening, and then kind of reset yourself before you start treating these patients.
And I'm just going to share this. I'm not going to say the name, but I am going to share this. But during this episode, as we normally do, Bradley posted a little post on our EMS Handoff Facebook group. And throughout it, we've had a few different comments, shared the quote that I used on here. But the very last, and it just came in, I wish we actually had more meaningful training on how to be compassionate. And that says so much. And so for that, you know, that's what we've been saying here. So as we wrap up today, just kind of realize that if that is truthfully a question that you have, reach out to all of us, reach out to Phil in this area, especially reach out to any of us. And let's try to find a way to do that for our profession. So as we wrap up tonight, we always like to say, we like to hear what your feedback is for us. So make sure to go by our website, emshandoff.com, and let us know. You can also reach us on Facebook. It's one of our most active places, but we also have LinkedIn and Instagram going as well. So make sure and stop by and say, hey, how are we doing? These comments are great. We'll reach out to this individual and the others here shortly as well. Excited to continue the message. Also, don't forget to go by Gems on Apple, Google, or Spotify. Subscribe, rate, and review so they know. And also make sure to visit our YouTube channel at the EMS Handoff. Hit that like button. Like. We know you're going. Hit the like button. Subscribe. Have a little bit of fun. See us every Wednesday at noon. And also, we started this last week with our Friday shorts. Just a short little message from either myself, Bradley, or Eric, something new that is out there as well. And then go get one of our shirts, our new EMS podcast, Stay Back 500 Feet shirts coming out tomorrow. And we'll see how those go. As always, for my co-host, Eric McCullough and Bradley Dean, take care, stay safe, and always remember the value of your EMS handoff.